Hi, I'm Yudi Bunyamin, and welcome to The Neumann Talk, a podcast where I meet past winners of the Australian Mathematical Society's B.H. Neumann Prize to learn about their journeys through the world of mathematics. Just a few moments after this episode is released, one or maybe two new Neumann winners will be named at the 2020 AustMS meeting. So we felt that it was only fitting that in her final moments as a reigning Neumann winner that we spoke to Dr. Trang Thi Thien Nguyen. Trang was born and raised in Vietnam before moving to Adelaide to continue her studies. She completed an undergraduate degree in mathematical sciences with a university medal in 2014 and honours in industrial and applied mathematics in 2015, both from the University of South Australia. She was awarded her PhD in 2020, and shortly after, she took up a short-term position at Macquarie University as a research assistant. Currently, she's a casual teaching staff member at UniSA. Trung jointly won the B.H. Neumann Prize in 2019 while she was a PhD student at the University of South Australia, working under the supervision of Leslie Ward, George Arau, and Ji Lee. What do you remember of your Neumann Prize winning talk, Trang? I mean, this is quite special because we actually share the prize, right? So
yep.
We won in the same year. So what do you remember of that experience?
It was quite special to me, actually, because it was the last talk that I could give at AustMS as a student. So it was quite special. And when I received that prize, I was really surprised about that, because I didn't expect that I could get the prize. There was a funny story behind it. So I also already have the experience in the previous AustMS. So at our talk, we can kind of guess who was our judge. So they normally as someone who came in before our talk and then just leave after our talk. But in my session, I couldn't guess who was my judge. And I was thinking if were there anything wrong, like there wasn't any judge who came to my talk. And then after my talk, I double-checked my application in the system of AustMS to see whether I have actually applied to be judged. And I realized that I clicked on the button saying that I have already submitted my thesis, which means I'm no longer eligible for this prize. So it made me think more that, there wasn't any judge who came to my talk. So that's the reason why I didn't expect that I could get the prize.
Had you actually submitted your thesis by then?
No. It was just an accident of clicking into that button.
Yeah. So when we sign up for the conference, there's a page where there are three buttons and we have to click one. The first one is, I'm not a student, so I'm not eligible for the prize. I just recently submitted my PhD thesis. And the last one is, I'm still a student, so yes, I'm eligible for the prize. Okay, so you clicked the wrong button.
Yep. So, of course, I changed it to the right button then, but I didn't think that it could make any difference. I still think that I was not eligible for that, and there wasn't any judge came to my talk. So, yep. So that's the reason why I was really, really surprised when my name was called out at the conference dinner.
Oh my goodness. I thought I was the only one who was surprised. I thought you wouldn't be surprised because, like, you've been to AustMS 5 times by then, which is a lot for any PhD student. Right. And you won an honorable mention before. I think you won an honorable mention in 2016.
That's right.
In fact, one thing I remember Masood saying before calling your name was, the next winner has won an honorable mention before, yep. Right? And he said, like, this person improved. So, yeah, I'm surprised that you think that you're really surprised.
Well, to be honest, I wanted to win the prize last year because, as I said, it was the last talk that I can give as a student. So I think I want to make it memorable. And then I was disappointed because I was not judged. So I didn't realize my name when they call my name.
Really?
Actually, the person sit next to me said that, I think they are calling your name. No, I don't think so. No. I think they are calling your name. Then I was like, okay. And even though I walked to the stage, but I'm still not sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I had to have the people next to me like, go! And the person sitting next to me is Grace Garden, who got honorable mention. Yeah. Oh my goodness. So you were gunning for it. Like, you really, like, did you prepare for that talk, like, extra hard and extra special because you wanted the prize?
I think from all the talk that I have presented, I put the same amount of effort to prepare for the talk, not just the one at OSMS last year. But I just have a little hope that probably I can win the prize to make my PhD journey more memorable. That's all.
You've been to OSMS 5 times, like I mentioned earlier. And did you speak at all 5 of them?
I spoke 3 times.
Okay. So, do you think you learned a lot from going to OSMS 5 times?
Yes. I think besides giving a talk, sharing our research, our work to everyone, I think it is a great opportunity to meet new people, other PhD students who are at the same level as us, and also meet other mathematicians. The experts in the field as well. I think, again, it is just once a year. We don't have that many opportunities where every mathematician around Australia and also over the world come together in one place. So I think it is very valuable.
Because most PhD students, I would say, if they ever get the chance to go to OSMS, it's once or twice, right? And that's partly because they might prefer to go to a more specialized conference, right? This conference more specialized in their area. But you've also done that. Like, I mean, you've been to a lot of conferences that are specific to your area. Why go to OSMS so many times in your PhD? Because I think, like, we are on the opposite ends of the spectrum in the sense that you are just about to finish when you won. And I just started 11 weeks fresh, just started my PhD, right? And I thought, like, maybe, I guess, like, how I end up at OSMS as an 11-week-old PhD student is a different story. But I thought, okay, this is going to be one of the few times that I go to OSMS. And now that I've won, I feel like, and not just I feel like people have said, you should go every year now. Mm-hmm. So why go to OSMS so many times?
I think I luckily to have that opportunity. I mean, in order to go to attend OSMS conference, we need the funding. We need to the financial support as well. And I'm so lucky that my supervisor, Leslie Wood, always encouraged me to go to the conferences, not just OSMS. And also another reason, so my research is specializing in harmonic analysis. And the harmonic analysis community in Australia is not very large. And going to the conferences is one way to networking, to make new connection with people within our field, within harmonic analysis. But I also would like to do more, which is we can develop the project that link harmonic analysis with another field as well, not just within harmonic analysis. So going to the OSMS, where people from every field comes in together, is a great opportunity for me to do that. If we go to a more specializing conference or workshops, we would not have many chance to meet other people in other fields, like going to the OSMS, I think.
Yeah, I think when the advice that my supervisors gave before I went to OSMS, because the following week I was going to go to a specialized conference, the advice she gave was, don't go to every single combinatorics talk because you're going to see the same people the following week. Like, take OSMS as an opportunity to diversify and go into talks that you don't understand, just so that you even just know that so-and-so works in this area. You are the first winner from the University of South Australia.
Really?
You didn't know that.
Yes,
you're the first
that.
Winner from UniSA.
Wow.
What was the reaction like when you won?
Well, they all congratulate me. And yes, the schools also put that news on the newsletter. Yes. And I received a lot of emails from people in the schools. Congratulations. But I didn't know that I was the first winner of UniSA.
Yeah. Like you said, it's even now I've realized like it's a good memory to have. And like for me, it's also opened up a lot of opportunities as well. You know, like I wouldn't be doing this podcast if it weren't for the prize. And it's really, I've now come to appreciate this is something quite special.
We should be proud of it. We should be proud of ourselves.
Yeah, I think maybe for you, because that means you've seen, if you've been to OSMS 4 times before that, you'd seen 8 people receive the prize. Like for me, I was someone like, I barely knew what it was. Right. And slowly I'm starting to appreciate, oh, like this is actually a lot more special than I thought. I know you were shocked to win, but I have to ask you, why do you think you won?
I think I presented quite well at OSMS last year. I was confident when I gave my talk. I motivated the audience quite well about why my research is interesting and important. I could show my contribution toward the project, toward the field. And I think I reached all the audience, almost every audience in the room, even though they may not understand 100% of my talk, but at least each of them can pick up at least something from my talk. And at the end of my talk, I engage with the audience quite well, answering their questions, and some of them even stayed later at the end of the session to discuss with me about my research and ask me more questions. Yep.
Maybe that is a sign. That is a good sign, because that happened to me as well. A lot of people wanted to talk to me after I gave my talk, you know, afternoon tea or things like that, about what I did.
Yes. It means they understand your talk and they are interested in your talk.
So what do you think is the secret? Like, what do you think is, what is your advice for all the people who are going to give a talk at OSMS in the future?
I think different people will have different ideas of what is a good talk. Besides all the basic requirements, such as well-structured, useful information on slides, speak clearly, and so on, there are 3 things that I always keep in mind when preparing for my talk. One, I try to make the point clear why my work is interesting and important. Second thing, I could show your muscle it means we need to claim what we have done, what is my contribution toward the project, what are the technical steps, what I have to do to overcome all the struggles. I think it is the important part of the talk. And this is where we capture the expressions of the audience. And this is where it makes the audience remember me and my talk. The third thing is I try to reach every audience. I think if we understand 60% of the talk, then we are already successful. So I will not expecting that all of the audience of my talk will fully understand everything in my talk. For example, at the OSMS talk, the audience are various from undergraduate students to professors and all the experts in the field. So how can we reach them all in 20 minutes? I would spend some time explaining the basic theory. The experts may get bored in this part, but the students may be interested and understand in this part. So that is where I'm trying to reach lower level of audience. But I also spend some time explaining more technical part of my work. For example, the proof of a theorem. Students may find it hard, but the expert will be more interested in this part. If students are interested in the technical parts, they can definitely stay later and discuss with me about my talk. Yep.
Okay, that's good advice. I'm taking notes too, because I've got many, many talks to give in my
group. So those are the three things that I always try to come across when I prepare for my talk.
Like, I'm sure for you, like for me, winning the prize has made this year a little bit more special. Like, you've gotten a lot of, we both got a lot of attention from winning the prize, and, you know, like, there have been opportunities since. But I'm just curious, as we sort of find new Neumann winners, one, maybe two new Neumann winners, I'm wondering if you have any advice for the next winners. So not advice, this is not like advice on how to win, but once you win, like, do you have any advice for them what to do after they win, or how to take advantage of the fact that you win the Neumann Prize?
Well, so there's one thing that I heard from my judge back in 2016 was that I don't remember exactly the number of students, there were many students who chose not to be considered for the prize. So they didn't want the judge to see their talk. So what does it mean? It means that students are still shy, are still not confident, talking about their research. And, you know, giving a presentation is a very important part of our professional career, right? So I think as a Neumann winner, we got to encourage students, other students more so that, well, I can do that. So of course you can encourage them more to give a talk, to be more confident in themselves, and we'll get better and better when you give more talk. Yep.
That's so interesting. For me, I was like, oh, like, I've got nothing to lose.
Yes, exactly. Why not?
You just have to tick a box. Yes. You know? And if anything, it guarantees that there are at least two people who will go to your talk. Like, you will not have an empty. Like, yep. Sometimes I'm worried it's just me and the chair.
Yeah, that's what I thought. But that's what we thought. But not every student think like us.
Yeah. No, but you're right. I feel like I always found that, where did I learn to give good talks in mathematics? It's from my supervisors and from watching other PhD students give talks, right? And I'm just thinking, like, I learned how to talk from you guys, like my fellow peers. So surely if all of you go, like, it should be, if you go to Ostermes or give a talk, like, it's like you have a good chance of winning. And I for whatever reason, like, we're trying to encourage, like, the other PhD students, come on, go to Ostermes, give a talk. Like, if I can do it, you can definitely do it too. Yeah, that's, yeah, I will second that. So, Trang, you grew up in Vietnam.
Yep.
And when did you move to Australia?
I went to Australia in 2009. So I did my high school here in Australia.
So you did basically everything up to year 10 in Vietnam.
Yep.
So why did you move to Australia at that particular point? Maybe it's a bit more common for people to move to Australia from countries like Vietnam or from Indonesia, for example, to start university. Why did you move at that point?
At that point, I was just a 16 years old little girl. And it was my parents' decision. They thought the education system in Vietnam is too heavy. Like, I have to go to school from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. And then I also had to go tutoring from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. So, and I also have to go tutoring in the weekend as well.
By tutoring, you mean like going to extra classes?
Yes,
for those
classes.
People who don't get to experience that part of life.
Yeah, having extra classes. So basically, mostly every day, I left home very early in the morning and then I arrived home at about 10 p.m. having dinner and then do more homework as well. So people may wonder, why did we have to go to the extra classes? Because every student do that. If we don't go to the extra classes, we may fall behind very easily. So they thought the education system is too heavy. And that's the reason why they sent me to Australia.
So what was it like the very first time studying in Australia?
Well, of course, language struggle was one of the big things, because not like many other students, they're gonna take an intensive course of English in their home country first before coming to Australia. But my parents decided a different thing, which is sent me here as soon as possible, then I'm gonna study English here as well. If we study English back in our home country, then the teachers maybe can still speak Vietnamese. So in some sense, it's still quite easy and quite comfortable. But if we study English in Australia, then everything is in English. Yep. So English struggle is one of the first things, but after a few months of studying intensively, I was able to order some food, some drink myself. I was able to ask for directions on the street. So I think I cope with the situations quite quickly. And for a little girls at that time, missing home, homesick is another problem. But so when I first came to Australia, homesick often came at the weekend when I didn't have to go to schools and I had so many free times. But after that, I participated in other clubs, like in Adelaide, we have Vietnamese International Association, where they organize a lot of activities for international students as well as I participated in the activities at my high schools as well. So things get better and better.
I also remember when I first came to Sydney. Yeah, the homesickness, you're right, on the weekend. That's when it's worst. Yeah. But, you know, here you are now, like, it's, you know, you turned out really well. obviously. And we talked a lot about like the struggle with the language, but I also want to know if there was any struggle with mathematics.
With mathematics, surprisingly, not. Well, even back in Vietnam, I was quite good at mathematics. Maybe, as I said, the education system is quite different. In Vietnam, we got to do a lot of exercises and really, really difficult exercises. But we didn't have much chance to see much applications of mathematics in the real life. As in, like in the system in Australia. But in particular for the mathematics as a subject at high schools, I didn't have much struggles with that. I think part of it because during my English course before going to high school, we also learned the languages in mathematics already. So it made it easier when I started studying mathematics at high school and also at uni. And now there are a lot of terms in mathematics that I only know in English, but I don't know how it's called in Vietnamese.
Yeah, because I think about maths in English now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think about maths in English now, and I don't know how to say a lot of mathematical terms in Indonesian. But I think it's just because, you know, the most intensive part of my mathematics education has been in Australia. And even before I came to Australia, there were times when I did learn maths in English. When you think about mathematics now, do you still think predominantly in Vietnamese or do you think predominantly in English?
Totally in English. there's a funny story about, so I gave a talk in Vietnam in 2018 and it was my first time ever I gave a talk related to mathematics in Vietnamese. Well, even though it was an international conference, and of course we got to choose to present in English, but I thought, well, this is the first time I give a talk in my home country and I'm Vietnamese. So I think I should give a talk in Vietnamese. That's why I tried my heart. I had to learn a lot of Vietnamese to prepare for that talk, to be honest, which is quite weird because I'm Vietnamese. But surprisingly, the audience gave quite a lot of good feedbacks about my talk. And my talk was actually rated as one of the impressive talk in the session that I participated. Yep, which is another memorable talk that I gave.
When you left Vietnam, or rather when your parents told you that you were going to leave Vietnam to come to Australia, was it ever in your mind back then, or maybe even in your parents' mind, that you would end up doing a PhD in mathematics, or even doing your undergraduate in mathematics?
No, actually choosing a mathematics degree as my bachelor degree, I changed my mind in the last minute. So in Australia, when we finished our year 12, and at my time, we got to choose six different preferences. And all of my preference was in the science area, like pharmacy, medical imaging, physiotherapy, something like that. Maths was not one in the list. And I didn't know about this. Well, during my year 12, I did some research about available degrees at uni, but somehow I missed the degree of mathematics. Then I changed my mind in the last day that I submit my application. And you may wonder why I changed my mind. Everything changed when I went to the open day of University of South Australia. And I attended the presentation of the program director of the mathematics degree. He introduced about the course. What are we going to study during the 3 years and what the degree will lead us to? And I was like, oh, this degree is definitely for me. Why didn't I know about this before? So I decided to change my mind, put degree of mathematics as my first preference in the list of 6 options. Yep. And my parents was in Vietnam, and I just told them once everything is done, once I already submitted my application. And even now, they still don't know what actually I'm doing. Every time when someone asks them, what do I do? What do I study? They still say that I am an accountant. Yep. So when I finished my bachelor degree, everything, it just came to me, I don't know how to say, but when I finished my bachelor degree, I didn't know what honors degree means. I didn't know what a PhD means. All of that is new to me. So at the end of my bachelor degree, my supervisor, Leslie Wood is also my honors degree supervisor. She came and asked me, could you like to do an honors degree? Then I was like, what is an honors degree? Yes, and then she explained to me, this is an advanced degree. If you complete this degree in the first class honors, you will have chance to do a PhD. And I was like, what is a PhD? So, my supervisor played a very important role in my professional life, actually. She guides me through honors degree and then towards PhD. Yep.
Why? That is so interesting. I want to come back to being an accountant. I think, at least for people like us, maybe it's hard to talk for more people, but say in Southeast Asia, for me personally, like I have relatives or, you know, like family friends who are like wondering, he's going all the way to Australia to study math? Like, why can't you do that here? Like, what's the difference? Like, why do you think your parents tell people that you're an accountant?
I'm the first one in my family who go to university. So they don't have much idea about how university is like. And of course, they have no idea about honors degree or PhD degrees. And being a mathematician is, so in their imagination, a mathematician is someone who spending time in their own office days to days, days and life, with a very thick pair of glasses, with very thick books, and they just isolated them from the whole world. That is what in their imagination. That was one of the reasons why they didn't really encourage me to follow this career. Like you, I receive a lot of questions from people back then, and also even my friends who are international students in Australia. Why do you come here to do mathematics? You can obviously do that in back home. But as I said, the education system is quite different. Of course, the system is getting better now over there. But at my time, we didn't have much chance to see how mathematics is applied in the real life. Why mathematics is useful, other than just doing the simple calculations. But that's the thing that I'm curious more and I want to know more. And I think if I did my PhD back in Vietnam, I would not have those opportunities.
So one thing we both have in common is that we grew up a huge chunk of our life, despite having been in Australia for so long, we grew up in our home countries still for a majority of our life so far, and also for the most formative years of our lives. Do you want to go back to Vietnam, you know, someday in the near future and settle there forever?
Yes, I do. One of the reasons is my whole family is still in there, and I've been away from them for so long. So I wish I could come back and live close to them. And one of my ambitions is that I want to use what I have learned in Australia to go back to Vietnam and contribute to the education in Vietnam. I'm not sure what I can do yet as an individual, but I still hope that I can make some contribution toward the improvement of education in Vietnam. I may not be able to come back there right now when I just finished my PhD. I still hope that I can gain some more experiences as a postdoc or as a lecturer, for example, in Australia for a couple of more years if I have opportunity before going back to Vietnam. Yep.
But do you ever worry about what am I going to do when I go back to Vietnam? Like your career prospects?
I do, yes. And also, I left Vietnam for quite long, more than 11 years already. So I'm sure that once I come back there, it would take some time for me to get used to the different lifestyle there. But I think there will be opportunities for me to develop my career back in Vietnam. I haven't found any yet, but I'm sure that there will be opportunities for me there. And together with my passion, my ambition to contribute to a better education system, I think we can work it out. Yep. Things will be okay. It just takes some time, I think.
Yeah. Okay. That's good advice for me, that like everything will work out in the end. Because I do worry, like, if I ever go back to Indonesia, what am I going to do? You know, like, mathematician isn't exactly the most prestigious job back home. And it's like one interesting thing you mentioned is how like it does change quite quickly. Especially Asia is like really growing. This is the time when it's really growing. And yeah, it's changing very quickly.
Well, because they are changing very quickly, it means Asia countries are coping and learning a lot from Western countries. So that's the reason why I am confident that there will be opportunities for us. And I'm not sure about in Indonesia, but in Vietnam, there are quite a lot of international schools, international universities, and the number is still increasing. There are more fundings toward the projects in STEM. So I think there are opportunities for us there.
Yeah, that's something I really wanted to talk to you about. Yeah, it's just how fitting that we share this prize in the sense that I feel like I'm seeing hopefully where I will be in about 3 or 5 years' time.
And it's interesting that both winners have got English and not the first language.
Yeah. I think by now, if people ask me what's my first language, I will say like my Indonesian and my English are the same. Okay. In the sense that I use them for different things. Mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe we have proven, the two of us have proven that, like, you know, you don't have to have like the most shiny, polished English ever to to win the Neumann Prize or to get your points across, at least in mathematics, isn't it? Yeah. Now I want to explore a bit about your research. So, Trang, I always like to put the question this way to our guests. If me, so not you, but if I was at the pub and I was speaking to a random person, right, and they asked me, what is Trang's research about? Like, what does she do? What do you want me to tell them?
So, astronomers keep looking for life in another planet. They wonder if, with different conditions in another planet, whether life still exists. My research has nothing to do with astronomy, but we have similar tasks. So in the classical mathematics, all results are proved on the setting of Euclidean spaces. I hope that everyone have heard about Euclidean spaces. So some examples of Euclidean space are the real lines, squares, cubes, or circles. Nowadays, pure mathematicians wonder if these results are still true if we change to a different setting, which can be more complicated and more general. So in my PhD thesis, I chose to work on the setting of spaces of homogeneous type. Spaces of homogeneous type are much more general and more complicated than Euclidean spaces. Some examples can be the coral reefs or the donut shapes as examples of spaces of homogeneous type. So we try to generalize some important results in harmonic analysis from Euclidean spaces to spaces of homogeneous type. I will not go into any details, but I think I will list some particular objects that I work with. So hopefully some of you may realize some of them. So I'm working with functions of bounded mean oscillation, BMO, functions of vanishing mean oscillation, VMO, quasi-conformal mappings, singular integral operators, and commutators. Yeah, so those are some technical objects that I work with.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, Euclidean space is basically like what we see in high school, right? And you're sort of seeing if the stuff that we learned about in Euclidean space still applies in other spaces, which admittedly some people may have a hard time imagining, but maybe that's, you know, not a problem. Yeah. Why did you become attracted to this area of mathematics? Now, it seems like because Leslie played a huge role in your career. Was it just because Leslie happened to be the person who came and talked to you?
Well, besides Leslie, there are some other professors who came and talked to me whether I would like to do an honors or a PhD with them as well. But the reason why I choose mathematics, it back to my bachelor degree. Harmonic analysis, or we call the mathematics of things that bounce, is a branch of mathematics that represent signals or functions as sums of oscillating waves. For example, we have learned about Fourier series. So we can present a function as a sum of sine and cosine, right? So sine and cosine are examples of oscillating waves. And I'm just into the beauty of sine and cosine waves and all other kind of oscillating waves. And harmonic analysis also has many applications in various areas. I can give you some example. The FBI has used the wavelet theory in fingerprint data, fingerprint data storage, compression, denoising, and the electrical engineers use the Fourier theory to improve the transmission, reconstruction, and noise cancellation in our voice when we make a phone call, or harmonic analysis is used to analyze and predict the behavior of oscillating systems such as atmospheric downbursts and their effect on power transmission lines. So those are some particular applications of harmonic analysis. Yep. So all of those initial motivation for me to study deeper about harmonic analysis.
One of the projects I saw that I found really interesting is that you worked on mathematical techniques to aid the Australian Army.
Yep.
I think this is what your honorable mention talk at AustMS was about. Is that right? Or
No,
that was the first time.
It was the first time I presented at AustMS back in 2015. Actually, in that year, we gave a group presentation.
Yeah.
So,
which is not normally.
Yeah, which is not normally. But that's what make the audience remember about us more, because we gave a group presentation. Yep.
So could you tell us a little bit about that project?
Yep. In that project, we work with the SDO, the Australian Defence Science and Technology Organisation, on a subsection of Australian Army's Land 400 project. That project involves replacing existing vehicles within the Army's current fleet with vehicles which are equipped with more modern technology. So in that project, we had to model some specific tasks which are performed in the Army. For example, searching for a target in an area, screening an object, and searching for enemy. We also had to investigate different decision-making techniques regarding vehicle selection. And in that project, we used the theory of Markov chain, linear programming, numerical methods, and optimization. Yep. It was a quite interesting project.
So when you added in the bit at the end, like all the things you use, like Markov chains, linear programming, that's the mathematical terms, right? Because I guess some people may wonder, why does a problem like that need mathematics, right? You're selecting new defense vehicles. Like when you're deciding to buy a new car, like there's not so much mathematics involved in that. Like, sure, you look at the price and everything, but why does a problem like choosing new defense vehicles needs so much mathematics that professors at a university need to get involved?
Well, I cannot explain all the maths that we have used in that project, but let me give a simpler example. So there are many different types of vehicles with different price, with different functions. How can we decide the number of each vehicles that we have to buy? We cannot just buy one type with a big number of vehicles and a very small number of vehicles for another type. It depends on many different criteria. It depends on all the tasks that the Army have to perform. It depends on the budget we are given. It depends on the current number of vehicles, whether they are still good to use or whether they need to be replaced. So we have to put all of those criteria into the account. This is where mathematics come in. The algorithm in mathematics, in particular linear programming, is used in here, could help us to find a feasible solution, an optimal solution, with all the given information. Yeah. So with our mathematics, how could you work out the number of vehicles that we have to buy for each type in order to satisfy all other criteria?
I guess it's worth mentioning that you mentioned linear programming, which is something that I've actually very recently learned about. Like, I've always known there's this thing called linear programming, but I only recently have taken a course where I've learned that. Like, when we say linear programming, like, I think a lot of people in the audience who maybe have, you know, like, say, high school students may think it's like computer programming, like writing code, but it's not, that's not actually what it is. It's linear programming is a method in optimization.
Yep.
I should let you briefly explain what is linear programming, but.
Well, but what you are saying is correct. It is a method in optimization. It is a mathematical algorithm that helps us find a visible solution, an optimal solution that satisfies all the different constraints.
So I guess like the Australian Army has actually decided on what vehicles they want to purchase based on your work and your team's work.
I have to say that this is a very, very big project and we are just a small part of it. We are not the final people who tell the DSDO that here are the numbers, vehicles that you need to purchase or something like this. We just contribute a small part of it and other teams will take the results of our project to keep working on the project. Again, we did this back in our bachelor degree as a group project. So I believe that even before us, they have already started working in this project and they still keep working on this project after us as well. So, yep, we are just a small part of that.
I guess what I'm getting from that is like not just applied mathematicians, but really all mathematicians. Most of them only work on a small part of a big project. Nobody is single-handedly solving big problems on their own. Yeah, it's not that simple. I'm realizing that in my PhD, like what I'm doing is so small compared to the big world, but also so important. Like without that, so many things wouldn't go ahead.
Well, as you said, to me, mathematics is a very important tool to in order to understand other part of science. I think all the projects in chemistry, in physics, in biology, for example, they still need some knowledge from mathematics in order to make their project go through. Yes, I think that is one of the reasons why you see mathematics is always one part of some project.
And I guess it must have been interesting to learn about the Australian Army and the vehicles that they use.
Yep. We also had chance to visit the site and we got to introduce to different type of vehicles, which was very nice. Yep. We learned a lot besides mathematics.
So, you know, the stuff you work on is quite technical. Like when I was reading through your publication lists and so on, it took us a long time to sort of even begin to gauge like, okay, Trung's work is in roughly this part of mathematics. And the stuff you do is some of the stuff that's more difficult to explain to, say, a general audience. I mean, forget about a general audience, like even other mathematicians, right? So, you know, I want to come back to the idea of giving talks or maybe just explaining mathematics more generally. One of the things that I heard someone say the day after we got our prize, I don't know if anyone said this to you, but I remember like the morning tea after we got our prize. Like, of course, a lot of people were congratulating me, but someone said what they really liked about the winners that year was that they were both technical, non-technical. They were saying like with me, I was giving an equity talk, which seems like it's not so technical. But actually, and I must say, like, this is the way I thought about it. Like, the way we did our project was we still approach it through a very scholarly approach, right? So actually, the talk was quite mathematical. Like, I did go into the conference thinking, I don't want to give an equity talk that I can give in any discipline, right? I want to give an equity talk that only people at the OSTMS can fully understand and appreciate, right? And then this person said, on the other hand, your talk is on something that's actually very technical, but you're able to describe it in a non-technical way. How do you take something so technical like harmonic analysis and explain it in a Neumann-winning way? What are the specific challenges you think in your area for that?
Yep. That is one thing that I often try hard every time when I prepare for my talk, because I'm a pure mathematician. I work with developing fundamental knowledge. So it is really hard for me to find a particular real-life applications where my research is directly applied. It's really hard. I think my strategy is try to explain the technical point using an informal example. Let me give you an example about how I explain the spaces of homogeneous type to the audience. So a spaces of homogeneous type is described by a triple. I'm going to use three symbols, X, rho, mu, where X is a set, rho is a quasi metric, which tells us how to measure the distance of any two points on a set, and mu is a measure, which tells us how to measure the mass of an object on the set.
So mu and rho are not numbers.
No. So to have the audience have a visual idea about spaces of homogeneous type, I will use the Bondi Beach at noon on a sunny day as an example of spaces of homogeneous type. In there, we define the set X as the Bondi Beach, okay? And the metric rho between two points on the beach is the usual length of the line segment connecting those two points. And the measure mu of an object is the area of the shadow cast by that object on the flat sand. Yep. So the Bondi Beach is an example of spaces of homogeneous type. And together with beautiful picture of the beach on the slides, I think it helped the audience understand about the technical definition that I'm trying to explain. Yep. So using the informal example of Bondi Beach to explain the technical definition of spaces of homogeneous type.
That is so interesting and so effective as well. And I like how you used Bondi Beach. Bondi Beach is quite close to UNSW. Like, I guess there are no world famous beaches in Melbourne near Monash. Okay, like Monash is quite inland in Melbourne. Okay, so I want to ask you the question that we ask at the end of every episode with all of our guests. And it's to complete the sentence, a mathematician is someone who... Actually, you already said what... Like, I think earlier you said your parents imagine a mathematician is someone who, you know, but that's... I guess you think that's not true. So a mathematician is someone who...
To me, a mathematician is someone who views mathematics as something which is of great beauty and profundity. I'm not sure how to describe the feelings, but I think the feelings of mathematicians for mathematics are similar to those of a composer for music, a poet for poetry, or an artist for painting. Yeah. And I believe that all mathematicians have some source of those feelings. Yeah. And as we may know, those feelings have been expressed by mathematicians, by many mathematicians in the past. For example, Hardy said I am interested in mathematics only as a creative art. Or Weier's Trust said that a mathematician who is not also something a poet will never be a complete mathematician. Or Einstein said that pure mathematics is, in its way, a poetry of logical ideas. Yep. So to me, a mathematician is someone who views mathematics as something which is of great beauty and profundity.
Thank you very much to Trung Nguyen for sharing her story, and as she passes on the title to the next winners, we wish her the very best in all her future endeavors. To find out more about Trung and her work, check out her website in the show notes. This episode was produced by Jody Lee and myself. Thanks also to Kevin Limanta for helping with this episode. We'll be back next week with another interview. Neumann Talk is a podcast produced by students and staff from the School of Mathematics and Statistics at UNSW Sydney and hosted by me, Yudi Bunyamin. Follow UNSW Maths and Stats on Facebook or Instagram to see updates on the latest episodes as well as other exciting news from our school. If you've been listening to our podcast, then we'd love to hear from you. Send me a tweet or a message on Twitter at @Yudi_Bunyamin. Let us know who you are and if there's something one of the winners talked about that really resonated with you, or even if you have any questions about mathematics of your own.